discussed how we wanted to go from itaminu to a more general metric, gminu. And then we realized that if we used our freedom to choose coordinates, we could in which gminu was equal to itaminu plus order x squared. Okay? And the obstruction to removing the x squared term was this were these certain number of second derivatives we could not remove by coordinate transformations. So we're going to focus now on these terms and understanding what they really mean geometrically. But before we do that, let me talk a little bit about tensors in general. Obviously, we're thinking of G as a tensor. And the definition of a tensor is that an object with a certain number of indices which transforms according to these the Jacobian matrix or the inverse Jacobian matrix. Okay, so tensors, you know, if we have some tensor with upstairs indices, with three upstairs indices, then the tensor in the coordinate system which is primed, so just prime everything, the argument and the object, in that coordinate system, it would be dx prime mu, dx alpha, etc. I don't want to use that one. Alpha, beta, gamma of x. Okay, and so upstairs indices transform with the Jacobian and downstairs with the inverse. There are various operations on tensors you can do to make other tensors, which are fairly obvious. So if I have a tensor with two upstairs indices and I multiply it by a tensor with two downstairs indices, that's still a tensor, right? Likewise, I can contract these indices. And that's still a tensor. It just has two fewer indices because these guys disappear as tensor indices because this one transforms using the Jacobian and this is the inverse, so the transformation disappears, right? So this is how you construct tensors from other tensors. You can add tensors as long as they have the same kind of indices. That's still a tensor. And then there's some interesting theorems which are useful. There's something called a quotient theorem. Which is that if A mu nu lambda, let's call it V lambda, is a tensor for all V lambda, then A mu nu lambda is a tensor. Okay, so if it happens that a contraction of some object with a tensor is a tensor, this would be a tensor with two indices, for all four vectors v lambda, then actually this must be a tensor. Okay, so that's not hard to prove. You just have to take different v lambdas and show this is true for all indices, all values of the index lambda. And likewise, let's call it the zero theorem. If a tensor A mu nu lambda equals 0 in one coordinate system, in any one coordinate system, then it's equal to 0 in all coordinate systems. Okay, and that's obvious because if the tensor is 0, when you calculate the tensor in the new coordinate system, all you're going to do is multiply by these matrices. And if the thing is 0, it's going to be still be 0 in the new coordinate system. So, but that's very useful to keep in mind, that I can use the freedom to choose coordinate systems to show, aha, it's 0 in this coordinate system. That means it really is 0 as a tensor in any coordinate system. Now, the main obstacle to creating new tensors is differentiation. Okay, so naively, you might expect d lambda a alpha beta to be a tensor. Okay, and d lambda by definition is d by dx lambda. Okay, but in general it is not. And this requires, what it's telling you is that the derivative operation is not a tensor operation in general. That derivative needs correcting. The derivative needs correcting in order to make it a tensor operation. So well, let's just check that explicitly. You see, if I have some vector v mu prime of x prime and I differentiate it, d by dx prime, let's call that nu and this one mu, right? So I have some vector v nu, differentiate it, and then prime the whole thing. And I want to know if the prime thing is just the Jacobian matrices times the original thing. Now we can change the derivative, that the partial derivative does transform correctly. Dx prime mu d by dx alpha, and the vector transforms correctly, mu dx beta v beta. But the problem is that I have to differentiate this Jacobian matrix. Okay, so this will give me one term which is correct, a tensor transformation when I differentiate the v. dv beta dx alpha, but then I get the other term, which is the derivative of the Jacobian matrix, v beta. Okay, so this is wrong. And essentially what we're going to do is change the definition of derivative to introduce an extra piece which will cancel this term. Cancel this. We shall introduce a connection to do that. Okay, but before I do that, let me motivate it a little more. To explain why that, where that connection comes from. Let me just tell you what the connection is defined to do. So gamma prime, the connection is an object which is not a tensor. It can't be a tensor because it has to transform in such a way as to cancel that term. And the connection is defined like this. It has three indices and part of its transformation is the usual tensor law. Okay, so that's the usual tensor transformation law from gamma to gamma prime, but there's an additional piece which there's this additional piece which is designed exactly to cancel that piece. Okay, so this looks a bit artificial when you first encounter it. But I'm going to try and make it less artificial by doing a couple of cases in which the connection arises completely naturally, and that will hopefully make it more reasonable. So let us try to see how gamma arises naturally in two contexts. Okay, so the first will be, I'll actually do that one first. First of all, if we do embed our curved space in a flat space, okay, so last time I said the whole point of Riemannian geometry was not to do that, actually. But I'm sure that when Riemann was thinking about it, the first model of a curved space would have been, you know, a sphere or some other space embedded in a flat space. It's certainly a good way to begin. So as a sort of elementary step, let's just put a curved space in a flat space and ask what differentiation means on that curved space. And secondly, if we consider the variational problem or action for a particle on a curved space. And in that case, too, we'll see how the connection arises completely naturally. So let's look at one. And I'm going to consider my curved space. Let's call it M. And imagine that M has D dimensions. Okay, what that means is that locally, at any point of M, there are D independent directions you can move in. And of course, we've already shown that locally, around any point, you can choose coordinates so that the metric is just the flat metric, eta, up to order x squared. So imagine this MD is now embedded inside some big space, which is R, and let's call it, I want some other word, let's call it E. Okay, this is the dimension of the embedding space. Maybe I'll call it N. It's clear it's an integer. Embedding space. Okay, so D is obviously smaller than N. Okay, in fact, John Nash proved, and you may have seen the movie Beautiful Mind. So John Nash did many interesting things in mathematics, and he proved that any MD, any D-dimensional manifold, can be embedded in Euclidean space of dimension D times 3D plus 1 over 2. Okay, and so that's a big number, but it's telling you that if you have a four-dimensional manifold, it can be embedded in, 13 times 4 over 2, so 26 dimensions, kind of interesting. So we're not going to take the embedding point of U at all, but nevertheless, this is a beginning. You see, we know very well how to differentiate in this space, okay, in this flat space, and so we're just going to ask, can I use that definition to help me differentiate within the surface? Yeah.
So this is asymmetrically embedded, right? Because you can embed it in a way that preserves the metric, right?
Isometrically embedded. Okay. Yes, that's what I'm going to use that. Yeah, I should. The technical term is isometrically. What that means, we'll see now. That basically the metric on this guy is induced from the metric in the embedding space. You know how to measure distances in the embedding space. You just use Pythagoras' rule, okay, which gives the flat metric in the embedding space. And if you use that metric to measure distances on the surface, then the geometry is well defined.
Even in the, for example, within the
manifold,
the kind of Lorentzian metric.
I'm not. Yeah, his theorem doesn't apply
for
Lorentzian.
All right.
I'm actually not sure what the generalization is. I presume it is still valid, but I don't know, actually. Somebody must have thought about that, but I don't know. His theorem was only for locally Euclidean manifolds, and this is not Euclidean space. This is not Minkowski space. This is So we're doing Riemannian geometry. Riemannian means the metric has four positive eigenvalues, or d positive eigenvalues. Okay. So how do we begin? Well, if I describe this curved surface inside the flat space with coordinates, let's call them x of little x. Okay, so this is a vector, capital X, with n components, and this little x vector has d components, right? So this has n components, and this is d components. And so you, as you run over the d coordinates of the surface, this guy is telling you exactly where the surface is in this n-dimensional space. We call this a parameterization. The x, the little x's, are parameters telling us where the surface is in the embedding space. Now we have tangent vectors. Vectors which are simply d alpha of x. Okay, because if I vary these parameters, what I'm doing is moving in the surface, right? So I've got my coordinate here, and then I vary it a little bit. Well, the derivative of the vector must lie in the tangent space to the surface. So these are the tangent vectors. Yes? Yes, exactly. So this is d by d little x alpha.
So there are d of them.
Alpha is 1d. And this index, I could give it a capital I. And this I is 1 to n. OK, so these are the tangent vectors. You can think of the I as the components of the vector. And the alpha is labeling which vector, right? And there should be d of these vectors because the manifold M is d-dimensional, right? So there should be d independent tangent vectors, each one a vector in the n-dimensional space. So then the induced metric on M is the one you get from the embedding space. And so it's just g alpha beta is d alpha xi d beta xj delta ij. So this is the metric in the original space, and this is the metric on the manifold M. And all this is saying is that the ds squared on the manifold is equal to dx is equal to the dx squared in the embedding space, where I only allowed this dx vector to have components in the surface. Okay, so this is the induced metric. And it transforms like a metric with respect to these coordinates alpha and beta, because these are derivatives with respect to alpha and beta. Okay, so it has the right tensor transformation law. When I change these parameters, little x, the big x don't change at all, right? They're just scalars which live from the point of view of the surface here. The big x's are just scalars, and they don't change. Okay. But the little x's change. In fact, let's call this thing E alpha. And so the metric is just E alpha dot E beta. Now, any vector in the tangent space to M can be written as V equals V mu E mu, just a linear combination of the tangent vectors. differentiate. Now we want to differentiate with respect to x, the little x's. And obviously, d alpha v is going to have two terms, one of which is the derivative of the components, e mu, and the other one is the derivative of the tangent vectors. Sorry, that is, I shouldn't put a vector there. The v mu's are components. Yeah, like that. Sorry, I didn't need an arrow here. The v mu are numbers which multiply these vectors. So when you differentiate a vector, you differentiate the components, and you also differentiate the basis tangent vectors. And this term is the origin of the connection. It's really saying that your basis vectors for the tangent space change as you move around the manifold. And so the interesting term is this one. We can write the derivative of a tangent vector as equal to gamma mu alpha. So part of it lies in the tangent space. This means in the tangent space. Okay, because it's some, it has some of its components are in the tangent space. But the other components are normal to the tangent space, k alpha mu n. And I think we will need some indices there as well. Let's put index I. Actually, I'll call them A. Okay, where these are normal vectors satisfying n dot e alpha equals 0. And there are going to be a certain number of them, and the A will go from d plus 1 up to n. Okay, so the number of independent directions in the embedding space is obviously capital N. D of them are tangent to the surface. There's a residual number, which are normal to the surface. And so any vector lying in any vector in the embedding space can be expressed as a part in the surface and a part normal to the surface. And this quantity k is actually called the extrinsic curvature. And it's not the part we want to worry about. We're only interested in this part. And this is the connection. OK, so in other words, if when we define, so when we define derivative within the surface, first of all, we differentiate the vector. And then what we're going to do is project out this piece. So you can think about differentiating the vector and then projecting it into the surface. And that will be the intrinsic. So we will project this out. To get an intrinsic derivative. Now, this E mu is the derivative of something, right? So this was defined to be, this thing is d alpha d mu of xi, or vector x. So this is symmetric under alpha goes to mu. And likewise, this connection must be symmetric under alpha. And so this gamma lambda mu alpha is symmetric under alpha goes to mu. And we define the covariant derivative derivative. Covariant is, remember, the name for downstairs indices. And a covariant derivative just means that it's a tensor with a downstairs index. The covariant derivative, but implicitly it's a tensor, that capital D V is equal to d alpha v plus gamma lambda, gamma mu lambda alpha v lambda multiplied, this is d alpha v mu multiplied by e mu. Okay, so the covariant derivative involves this ordinary derivative piece. I add in the connection piece. The connection from here, the connection gamma lambda mu alpha is just equal to this dotted with the E. By definition, the N vanishes, and so gamma lambda mu alpha is E lambda dot d alpha E mu. Let me just see, just want to check it's normalized properly. Yes, where I have defined this E with the upstairs indices, where E lambda dotted with E alpha is delta lambda alpha. Okay, so the E vectors with upstairs indices are just the duals of the E's with downstairs indices. Okay, so if I dot this equation with an E with an upstairs index, this guy's going to go away. And in fact, what I should have done is put the alpha up there.
Yeah, so gamma is not a tensor.
Pardon?
Gamma is not a tensor.
Gamma is definitely not a tensor. Okay, so you had one error, and you're going to fix it by committing another error. Okay, that's the whole idea of gamma. So this kind of manipulation would have been what, I guess, Riemann would have done first of all, just to get a picture of what it means to differentiate in a surface. And Gauss had already done this In fact, I think Gauss might have been Riemann's supervisor. One of the Gausses, I think, was his supervisor. This is the also called the Gaussian curvature. So probably he had some input from Gauss. Okay, so that's one example. Let's do another example, two, to see this need to correct the derivative. Okay, so what we're going to do is consider a particle moving on MD. And I'm not going to worry about it being time and space or whatever. I mean, this can be a Riemannian manifold. We can still define a variational principle. All the algebra is identical. So let's take the action is proportional to, and I won't worry about the constants of proportionality, d lambda square root. Yeah, okay, let me put the minus sign in just so that it does agree. We have to put this in if it's a massive particle. Dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. Just keep in mind that this minus sign would disappear if we're doing Riemannian. There's no need for the minus sign. It's only when we do pseudo Riemannian or signature minus plus 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 that we need this minus sign.
Is that there?
Not there.
Is that the most simple action that we can write?
Yes. In fact, yeah, I would say it's unique, except somebody would come and correct me. Yes, it's a simple action we can write. Why? Because this is the invariant length of the line, and the simplest attribute of a line is its length, its total length. Why did we take the square root? That we took the square root in order to ensure that these lambdas cancel from the formula. I really don't want the length of my line to depend on how I parameterize it. You see, this is a very fundamental notion where you, when you do general relativity or the theory of manifolds, is that you have in your head the picture of a geometrical object, which is structureless. It has no structure. It's literally a line. That's what it is. Okay. Now, the problem is that we human beings are pretty feeble, and we cannot do mathematics with that. We don't know what to do. Okay. So as primitive as we are, what we do is we draw lines, marks on it. Okay. That's our lambda. And we say, okay, well, I'm going to have to introduce some labels, which are numbers, and then I will describe the geometry using those numbers. But I know those numbers on their own are meaningless, right? Because if I picked one parameter along the line or another parameter along the line, it really shouldn't make any difference. I'm trying to describe a structureless line. Okay, so that was somehow the intuition I think Riemann had, and certainly Einstein had, is that space-time is this bent thing. Okay, it doesn't come with any coordinates. The coordinates are completely human introduced artificial things, which unfortunately we need to do any calculations. And so it's quite amusing that actually when mathematics, and I think students often get very confused about this, that they say to me, oh, everything you're doing has coordinates and you have all these indices and, you know, there's nothing geometrical. You're not doing this in terms of the geometrical quantities. And many textbooks, especially by mathematicians, try to hide the coordinates and they write everything in so-called coordinate-free notation. Okay, and in fact, in cosmology, there's something called gauge invariant cosmological perturbation theory. All those words are completely meaningless. Okay, when you do calculations, you need numbers and you need coordinates. And so it's infamous that among mathematicians who actually work on this field, every time they do a calculation, they will actually use coordinates. But when they write the paper, they they try to hide the coordinates as much as possible. Okay, so don't be afraid of coordinates. They are a necessary evil. But of course, it's always good to try to make sure that your final answer doesn't depend on the coordinates. It shouldn't. The coordinates are a human artifice. Okay, so this is a very fundamental sort of aspect of geometrical theories, is that we have to introduce coordinates, but they're really evil things which we want to eliminate from any answer. So in particular, if I do a calculation in one coordinate system, people would very rightly say to me, why should I believe your answer? Have you checked it's the same in another coordinate system? And indeed, I need to be really confident that whatever answer I've got is valid in any coordinate system. Otherwise, it's not a physical answer. Okay, so this is the way of ensuring that the lambda doesn't really matter. Okay, so if I change lambda to lambda prime, lambda goes to lambda prime of lambda, then of course we have d lambda prime over, and then we have the square root d lambda prime d lambda prime. This is equal to d lambda over the square root of d lambda d lambda. And so the variational principle at least does not depend on the parameterization. There's always implicitly the notion that the map from the line, the actual geometrical line, to the lambdas is 1:1. One point on the line should correspond to one value of lambda. And that means that this transformation of lambda to lambda prime has also got to be 1:1. In particular, its Jacobian cannot vanish. Right? So if I have lambda prime against lambda, and this went flat, so the derivative vanished, that would be that many points in lambda have the same value of lambda prime. And that's bad. It means lambda prime is a bad parameterization of the line. Okay? So we want to ensure that, so we insist that, well, here it's just one is positive. So we insist. And this is the same condition that the Jacobian matrix be invertible. Okay, so here we have our variational principle. So let's vary it. So delta S equals, and now I get d lambda. So I'm going to vary the square root. That gives me a factor of 1/2. I put the square root on the bottom, g mu nu, dx mu d lambda, dx nu d lambda. Of course, this g mu nu does depend on x, and x does depend on lambda. Okay, it's the metric calculated on, you know, at the relevant point on the line. So I'm going to have to vary that. So when we vary it, we're varying the stuff inside the square root. I get g mu nu comma alpha delta x alpha. That just means differentiate g with respect to the coordinate and then vary the coordinate. That's the first order variation of the metric, dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. And then I've got to vary these things. This is symmetric under mu goes to nu, so I can just vary one of them and multiply by 2. So this is dx nu d lambda, d delta x nu d lambda. Okay, so that's the full variation. And now there's a nice trick, which is to say, this quantity, after all, is the this is d tau d lambda, right? Remember, d tau is d tau squared is minus g mu nu dx mu dx nu. So this is d tau squared. Yeah, so the quantity including the square root is d tau d lambda. And if I do that, you see I can just remove all the lambdas from the equation. So these two terms have two inverse d lambdas and one in the numerator. This guy is d tau d lambda, so all the d lambdas will cancel. And so what I can do is write this as 1/2. So this is this whole thing is 1/2 times d tau, and then minus g mu nu, comma alpha delta x alpha dx mu d tau, dx mu d tau. And so I've got rid of all the d lambdas, g mu nu dx mu d tau dx nu d tau, d delta x nu d tau. Right, so now I just do the usual thing with actions of integrating by parts to get rid of the derivatives on the variation. And I'll just write down the answer. This is 1/2 integral. I'm going to write d by d tau as dot to simplify things. D tau, the first term is g mu nu comma alpha x dot mu x dot nu delta x alpha minus 2 g mu nu comma alpha x dot mu delta x nu minus 2 g mu nu x double dot mu delta x mu. Okay, so to get that, all I did is integrate by parts here. I got, I seem to have a minus sign wrong. Oh, I see. That should be a plus. Just yes. Okay. This and actually this one should be plus as well.
And the other one minus.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay, so so now what I do is just as usual with actions, I set the coefficients of the variation to 0 because the variation is arbitrary, and so now I'm left with this equation. So this delta s equals 0 for all delta x nu of tau. And so this results in the following equation, that 2 g mu nu x double dot mu, g mu alpha x double dot mu plus, and I'm going to write it this way. Let me try and justify that. So this expression here, you see the x dot term is obviously symmetric under replacing alpha with mu. So I'm free to write this term as g mu nu comma alpha plus g alpha nu comma mu. And that's what I've done here. Okay, so I've replaced this term with this, just to make it more symmetrical. And this is the last term. Okay, so now what we do is multiply by the inverse metric, g, let's call it g beta mu, to eliminate this guy, divide by a factor of a half, and okay, so what we get is that x double dot beta plus 1/2 g beta alpha g mu alpha comma nu plus g nu alpha comma mu minus g mu nu comma alpha x dot mu x dot nu equals 0. And we will define this quantity to be the following symbol. Okay, curly brackets with the three indices, symmetrical on the lower two indices. On mu nu, and this is called a Christoffel symbol. And this is actually the simplest case of a connection. Okay, so what is going on here is that the second derivative of x, even though what is going on is that even though the velocity, so dx alpha d tau, this is a tensor, right? Because if I prime everything, I should leave tau invariant. Tau doesn't care about the coordinates. Tau is the proper time along the curve. And so this is a tensor because dx prime is certainly dx prime alpha dx beta d tau, right? So the four velocity of a particle is a tensor. It's a four vector. But if I differentiate again to find the acceleration, that is not a tensor because I've got to differentiate the Jacobian matrix again, right? So this is going to give me dx prime alpha dx beta d2x beta d tau squared plus, and then I've got to differentiate this guy. And how do I differentiate it? Well, I get d2x prime alpha dx beta dx gamma times dx gamma d tau. Multiplied by dx beta d tau, right? And this is the wrong term to be a tensor. This is wrong for x double dot beta to be a tensor. And so the reason the Christoffel comes in is exactly to cancel that term. Okay, so again, this would be a sort of simple case where you can see you need a correction term. And we can work out the transformation law of the Christoffel symbol very easily. Let me see, I think, yeah, that's broken. Since I've just used it, let me just use the other blackboards. So we can show that, can easily show that gamma, that, sorry, this Christoffel symbol prime is equal to dx prime dx times the Christoffel symbol. And let's put some indices now. Rho delta epsilon, delta epsilon mu alpha rho. And then with the correction term, dx prime d rho dx rho dx prime mu d2x rho dx prime mu dx prime alpha. Okay, and that d by d tau of dx mu d tau, sorry, d by d tau of, yes, d by d tau of dx mu d tau, okay, which I will define to be d2x mu d tau squared plus Christoffel mu alpha beta dx alpha d tau dx beta d tau is a four vector. Okay, so the bad transformation properties of the first term get canceled with the transformation properties of the second term. Okay, so those are the two examples, and let us now discuss this a bit more formally. Yeah.
Sorry, can I just ask?
Yeah.
When you said that, I think you just covered the point there, but that the square root of g minus g mu,
yes,
dx mu d lambda, dx mu d tau is d tau d lambda.
That's right.
Does dg mu d lambda not come into d tau d lambda?
Sorry, let me write this down.
Yeah, sorry, you said that was d tau d lambda?
Yes, because d tau squared is by definition minus g mu nu dx mu dx nu.
Yeah, so then why is there no dg mu nu d lambda if g mu nu is a function of x of lambda?
I'm just taking the square root of this equation. What I'm doing is dividing this by d lambda,
yeah,
twice, dividing by d lambda, and then taking the square root. That's all I'm doing.
So there's no
d, there's no differentiation of anything in the equation, just algebra.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just doing, it's an algebraic manipulation. No differentiation at all. Any other questions? Okay, so let's proceed a little bit more formally now. Hopefully we're convinced that derivatives are not good enough. We have to correct them. And so we have to introduce this, the correction terms. In order to define a derivative which will have meaning in any coordinate system or independent of the coordinates. And so we define, so in general, we define a covariant derivative, d mu. And so that I use instead of, so remember partial d mu was just d by dx mu. The covariant derivative is written with a capital symbol, nabla, I think it's called. And d mu of some tensor with some indices upstairs and downstairs, what you find is that you must define the covariant derivative this way as the ordinary partial derivative, and then you have to correct it with connection terms. And the way the connection terms work is that every time I have an index here, I contract the connection with that index. So basically that index alpha got projected onto the connection, and then the connection has the inherits the index. The mu, in my convention, the derivative index will always be last on the gamma. Other people use different conventions. So the derivative index always appears here, last. So for every upstairs index on the tensor I'm differentiating, I get a plus sign with a connection. Plus dot, dot, dot. These are all the other upstairs indices. And then I have to have minus gammas for all the downstairs indices. So the one I've given you, minus gamma A beta, gamma beta mu A. So now I have to contract with the downstairs index. So every downstairs index is first projected onto the gamma, and then the gamma inherits the index. And again, the derivative index is last. So minus, and then the other downstairs indices. Okay, so this is the general definition of a covariant derivative. Plus sign for upstairs indices, minus sign for downstairs indices, and this transforms as a tensor. Now, I want to mention one subtlety, which is usually not discussed in textbooks, which is that the difference between that connection and this Christoffel symbol. Okay, so very often the textbooks will just go from one to the other without justification, but there is a subtlety, which is a quantity called torsion. Now, let's see. We have already discussed the transformation of gamma. You see over here, this is the transformation law of gamma. And the bad part of it is this guy, the second derivatives. But notice that actually this term is symmetrical and a nu goes to alpha, right? Okay, so notice that the bad term in the transformation of gamma given in star is symmetrical in the lower two indices. And so what that means is that if I define this quantity to be the antisymmetric connection, antisymmetric part of the connection, okay? So the antisymmetric part just means obviously subtract the same thing with indices reversed. This quantity is a tensor. Okay, that's a perfectly good tensor because in the transformation law, the last term will vanish. Now, what does that mean? It means that somehow this gamma has a part of it which is playing a geometrical role in canceling bad terms in derivatives, but it has another part of it which has a sort of legitimate existence as a tensor, okay? And this is called the torsion. This is the torsion. Okay. It is an independent assumption that the torsion vanishes. And in general, it does not. Okay, so this torsion really is another field, like the Maxwell field or something else. It exists, has a real existence, particles could couple to the torsion. And if you write down a general theory, and you will in general find it has torsion. Okay, in fact, even the standard model, subtleties come in, but if you introduce fermions, fermions in the simplest so-called first order formalism, then even the standard model gives torsion. But it's very small.
Does the torsion have quantum?
Yes, it's a field. The torsion is really a field.
What's the quantum of the torsion?
Just like every other field. It needs to be quantized like everything else.
It can be like measured or something like that.
Yes.
Torsional?
Yes. In principle, it can be measured. Okay, but it's very, very small. It turns out that this torsion, this T mu nu lambda, if I lower the index, so what we do is we write this object, T mu nu lambda, where I've just lowered the index, G mu alpha T alpha nu lambda. And special things happen if the torsion with lowered indices is totally anti-symmetric. Okay? And it happens that in this minimal case, it is totally anti-symmetric. In the standard model, it is proportional to psi bar. Gamma, mu, nu, lambda, anti-symmetric, psi. Okay, so it depends on the, this is going a little far afield, but the density of a fermion, like the density of electrons, is proportional to psi bar psi, where psi is the fermion field. And so this is proportional to the density, of fermions. And furthermore, it's actually proportional to the spin density. It's not just the number density. They all have to be spinning in the same direction for this quantity to add up. And that introduces torsion into gravity. And in principle, it's measurable. But in practice, it's minuscule. Okay, so just to warn you that the torsion in general does not vanish. But what's kind of nasty about it is you need separate field equations to determine it. Okay, so it could be there, but you need a whole additional sort of superstructure to predict what the torsion is. So the simplest assumption is just to say it vanishes. Okay, and that's actually what Einstein did.
What is the spin of this field?
Pardon?
The spin?
Spin. Yes. You know, the spin of an electron.
No. What is the spin of this field?
The spin of this field?
Yes.
Well, this is a tensor with three indices. So it transforms under the Lorentz group as an object with three indices. I can't tell you exactly what the spin is, but it's, probably can. I mean, we know that F. F mu nu has spin 1, so this is presumably. I couldn't say offhand. But it's certainly some transformation under the Lorentz group. So in the notes you'll find some calculations. Basically, I don't want to dwell on this. Just to warn you, this thing exists. Let me see. So the statement is that if the torsion vanishes, T. Well, there's a stronger statement, actually. Let me say it this way. The simplest assumption is that I've already said it here. T mu nu lambda vanishes. Okay, so that's the simplest assumption. So you don't want to think about it, so set it zero. Okay, it is a tensor, and it's more or less like saying I discovered the electromagnetic field, but I didn't want to think about electromagnetic fields. I want to do physics without them, so I'm just going to set them all zero. Okay, and that is consistent. I mean, that it's consistent to do so, except when you have fermions present, and there are even some other caveats. This first order formalism, you can go to another formalism in which you can get rid of the torsion, but it becomes dependent on a sort of chain of assumptions. There's a general statement you can make, which is kind of interesting, that if you if the torsion is totally anti-symmetric, Uh, And that means if I lower the index in this guy, so this tensor T mu dot nu lambda is totally antisymmetric. So this would be equal to minus T nu dot mu lambda, etc. Then, and if we impose metricity, so metricity means that the covariant derivative of the metric is zero. Then the Christoffel symbol, sorry, then the connection equals the Christoffel symbol. Sorry, that isn't right either. Then the symmetric part of the connection is the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so this is a bit more general. The simplest assumption is just to set the torsion zero. If the torsion is zero, if T mu nu lambda equals zero, then metricity G alpha beta equals zero implies that the connection mu nu lambda is the Christoffel. Okay, we'll prove that in a moment. So that's the simplest assumption. There's a slightly more general statement, which is that even if the torsion is antisymmetric, the part of the connection, part of the connection would be the torsion, and the symmetric part would be the Christoffel symbol. So you'll find this discussion in the notes, but let me just prove this. It's the simpler case. But I just want to warn you that in general, when you get to more complicated theories, you will find they do possess torsion. So let's start with that one. So we already saw that we can always choose coordinates so that g mu nu comma alpha equals zero at a point. At a particular point. Okay, so we always have the freedom to choose coordinates so that the first derivatives of the metric vanish at a single point. And so it's quite natural to ask the question whether we can set the covariant derivative of the metric equal to zero at all points simultaneously. Okay, so this is an assumption. The reason to make the assumption is you want to somehow determine the connection. You need an equation that fixes the connection, gamma. And this is a very logical equation to use. Is you say, well, I'm just going to assume that the metric itself is covariantly constant, i.e., metric is covariantly constant. constant. And that is also called metricity. Okay, so it's an assumption, but it's an assumption which will determine the connection. And so let's just write that down. Try and get the indices right. Sorry, let me just change these indices so I don't get confused. And so we're going to solve this. We can solve star for gamma. And we do it using the same old trick that we used before. So let's write out this equation, g beta gamma comma alpha. That's the ordinary derivative term. And then we have two gammas corresponding to the two lower indices on the g. Okay, so all I've done here is project on that index of the g. It comes down to here, and then project on the second index of the g. G is symmetric, so it doesn't matter which order I place these indices. Projected on the second index of the metric. And now we use Riemann's trick. We just add this and subtract it. We add it with flipping. Okay, let me just see. So I just flipped alpha and beta here. Didn't change this at all. This term let me write it out and I'll justify it afterwards. G rho gamma. Okay, so flipping alpha and beta, obviously this one goes to that. This one goes to that. And then we're going to subtract G alpha, beta, comma, gamma, which is subtracting gamma going to alpha, I believe. Gamma with alpha, or let's call it alpha goes to gamma. Okay, so minus plus gamma rho alpha gamma g rho beta plus gamma rho beta gamma g rho alpha. Okay, so the sum of all these things should be zero because each of the three lines is zero. And now in this part, everything should cancel, except for two terms. Let's see what cancels. So the alpha, and let me do them in red. This term cancels that one. And this term cancels this one. And these two are identical. And so what I see from this is that gamma rho alpha beta g rho gamma equals 1/2 g beta gamma comma alpha plus g alpha gamma comma beta minus g alpha beta comma gamma. And now I can just multiply by the inverse metric. So gamma rho alpha beta is 1/2 g rho gamma times the same thing. And of course, that is the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so metricity plus the assumption of zero torsion imposes that the connection is the Christoffel symbol. Okay, I think I better stop there. Are there any questions? Well, maybe I'll just tell you briefly. Next time, we're going to use these covariant derivatives with the connection. I'm going to assume the torsion is zero. We're going to use the covariant derivatives to analyze curvature of the manifold. It'll turn out, so partial derivatives commute, ordinary partial derivatives commute, but these covariant derivatives do not. And the fact they do not, or the commutator between these covariant derivatives gives rise to something called the Riemann curvature. And again, this is a very, very general theme in gauge theories. We also have covariant derivatives involving the vector potential, and their commutator gives the electromagnetic field. Okay, so the F mu nu, you know, what is this thing? This F mu nu, d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. Well, in fact, what it's equal to is d mu plus a mu, d nu plus a nu. And there's some I's floating around as well. Okay, something like that, minus I. But apart from the I's, the commutator, this is the covariant derivative in field theory. Again, the ordinary derivative is bad because it spoils gauge invariant, so you correct it with the vector potential, and the commutator of the derivative gives the field strength. So what we're going to do is the same in gravity. We're going to see that the Riemann tensor rho sigma is, roughly speaking, d mu d nu. That the commutator of this, well, those indices aren't going to match at all, so let me put a vector in there. The commutator of covariant derivatives on a vector is going to give the Riemann tensor, which measures the curvature. Any questions? Okay, and then immediately after that, we're going to formulate the Einstein equations in terms of the curvature of space-time.